From the Autoline Studios, here is your host, John McElroy.
I want to thank you all for joining us on Autoline this week. As you all well know, automakers are under pressure to greatly improve the fuel efficiency of their vehicles and reduce emissions at the same time. And of course, that all comes down to powertrain, which is today's discussion. And I've got three experts in to talk just about that, including Oliver Schmidt from Volkswagen of America, Todd Haynes, the CEO of a company called XL Hybrids, and Chris Thomas from BorgWarner. And it's great to have all three of you here. Oliver, let me start with you. As I look out at what the auto industry is working on, I'm blown away by the variety of powertrains. Mm-hmm. We have the typical internal combustion engine that runs on gasoline or diesel. We've got hybrids. We've got plug-ins. We've got electrics. We've got fuel cells coming. We've got CNG and LPG. And my question is, how can the industry possibly market so many different types of powertrains?
I think the big problem here is not the industry in total. First, it's the sole manufacturer. So first, every manufacturer has to define his own pathway to the future. So you basically have to sit down in strategy meetings and decide what you are going to do. So basically, the company I work for, the Volkswagen Group, we defined our strategy. We are going to turbocharged direct injected engines, gasoline and diesel. We will go to plug-in hybrids and we will do electrified vehicles. So this is our strategy. But you're right, for the consumer, because you have other companies that go a totally different way, that say, no, we need big displacement Atkinson engines. For the consumer, it gets pretty confusing. So this is then for the marketing people, which you don't have here today, but that's for the marketing people in the future to determine how to market the advantage of the system the brand is offering.
And we sell directly to commercial fleet customers. So we're actually able to go to the customer and get data around how they're using those vehicles. Mm-hmm. And then we can analyze based on their drive cycle and usage requirements, which powertrain is going to be the best fit for them. Now, we're focused on selling a hybrid electric powertrain, so we're targeting customers where they're going to primarily have good drive cycles for that type of powertrain. But you can expand that capability to identify where it makes sense for a plug-in or where it makes sense for a different type of technology.
And you sell hybrids to commercial truck companies. So don't you have a somewhat easier time because they're so focused on cost? If you can give them the right numbers, they'll be interested in your product. And with the general public right. buying cars, it tends to be not always a bit more emotional in how they purchase.
Right. We're very focused on reducing the total cost of ownership for our customers. So it is really a financial decision. It's driven by numbers. And that's one of the reasons we can really leverage the data capabilities, which we've built into our platform. So we do have a wireless link to the hybrid system that can collect all that operational data and provide feedback in very real time to the fleet managers.
You need to keep in mind that's commercial vehicles on road, right? When you talk about commercial vehicle off road, the requirements for those customers are quite a bit different. They're all about productivity, how fast you can plow the field, how fast you can run your combine harvester, and how much you can get done in a day. Not just the actual fuel consumption. So there's a lot of other things that come into it when you start talking about off-road.
Chris, let me stick with you for a minute. BorgWarner, of course, is, I think, the largest or certainly one of the largest turbocharger suppliers in the world.
Sure.
You're heavily involved in all different kinds of transmissions. We'll get into some of that, too. But how does BorgWarner look out at this? In so many of the different types of powertrains I mentioned, turbochargers and transmissions play a role. But in some, like electric vehicles, you don't need a turbo. You probably don't even have a transmission in some of them. Same with a fuel cell car. So what's BorgWarner's look over the next 5 to 10 years as to how the market will develop?
Well, I think some of those products are still high growth markets, and we like high growth. So on fuel cells, you know, we're developing a fuel cell air supply system, and we've got several different customers we're working with. If you think about a fuel cell, you have to blow air in, right? And that's basically a compressor. And then you also have to throttle the fuel cell stack so that to maintain a pressure across the membrane. Well, rather than throttling it, we put a turbine on the exhaust, and it looks a lot like a turbocharger, except we have a 22 kilowatt electric motor in the center to power this.
No, wait a minute. So you're using the exhaust to drive a generator, essentially?
No, we use the exhaust to drive the compressor, which blows the air in, because you have to have a pressure drop across the fuel cell stack.
Oh, I misunderstood. I thought you said you were using some of this power to generate electricity.
No, we use it's a single shaft that has a turbine on one end and a compressor on the other, just like a turbocharger. Mm-hmm. But we have a 22-kilowatt motor in the center to actually push the air in.
Oh, I see.
But rather than just throttling it and losing the energy coming out of the fuel cell, we recover that in a turbine. So we're into those. You know, electric vehicles, the original Tesla transmission was BorgWarner design. There's other things we've got in the pipeline for that type of a product. So I think there's opportunities in all of these areas, and we're looking at all of them all the time and reassessing, where we need to play.
Oliver, you mentioned Volkswagen turbocharging, then going to plug-ins and electrics. A little over a year ago, you let me drive one of your electric cars, an electric Golf. I thought it was terrific, but electric cars just don't seem to be catching on. Oh, how do you evaluate where this segment may go?
So the first thing is electric vehicles are driven by the ZEV mandate in California. So this is... It's basically not a choice. You're forced to sell those vehicles. And depending on which regulation you are under, if you are a small manufacturer or intermediate or whatever, you have to sell those vehicles. So I don't want to say we need to sell these vehicles, but we need to sell those vehicles to be compliant in this market. And every manufacturer is driven to do so. So then the differentiator that we see in our product is basically, if I look at the electric vehicle market at the moment, it is vehicle that look electric vehicle that sell good. It's two cars that dominate the electric market. It's the Leaf, it's the Tesla. Those cars, if you look at them, they say, I'm an electric vehicle. And there will be one day down the road when this becomes mainstream. And then people want to experience what they are used to in their electrical vehicle. And this is what we try to do with the electric Golf first, that we want to give the customer the experience of really, you had a Golf before or a Jetta or whatever, and you get the same feel in the electric vehicle. This is our approach to electric vehicles. And then, of course, combined with the drivability of the electric vehicle driven by the huge low-end torque.
Todd, so far, hybrid commercial truck, or I shouldn't say commercial, I should say hybrid trucks haven't really set the world on fire. Mm-hmm. How's it going on the commercial side of the business?
Well, the commercial side is much different than the consumer market. Consumers typically drive 10, maybe 15,000 miles per year. They're not using a lot. Yeah, that might be a lot for global numbers. They're not using a lot of fuel.
Yeah.
Commercial trucks or vans that are driving 20, 30, even 40,000 miles a year, some cases 60,000 miles a year, are using a lot of fuel. So if you can create a system that can reduce their fuel consumption and save them money in the process, you can provide a very good payback. One of our customers, Coca-Cola, actually has done a large rollout at the end of last year and is buying more. They're getting a 3x return on their investment. So for them, it's a financial decision. And that's the kind of product that I think can scale rapidly and have a big impact. But you do have to focus on that half of the market in the commercial world that's driving over 15 or 20,000 miles per year.
This is exactly our experience that we have in Europe. In Europe, we have Volkswagen Commercial, we have MAN, we have Scania, and it's really a passenger car or a light-duty truck. There, somebody makes a decision. They want to look good in the vehicle. The vehicle needs to suit them. Commercial vehicles are a whole fleet is bought by one person based on a financial decision. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different world there that we see in those vehicles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And tell your story a little bit, because I find it fascinating that you're not a car manufacturer. You're kind of a supplier, but you supply turnkey hybrid systems that can be put in trucks and vans. Or you tell it, not me.
That's correct. We make a battery electric system that can get added to a commercial truck, either during the production process or on vehicles that are already in the road. It's an electric motor, battery inverter, and everything that's connected to the vehicle and the software and controls. And that system can then capture energy that's normally wasted in braking, and it reduces fuel consumption by approximately 20%, depending on how the vehicles are used, but that's really the target customer. What we've also done is developed a process by which we can get that technology to market very rapidly. There's already upfitters, companies that are modifying these vehicles, putting the shelving packages or the box truck on the back. They can do the installation. They're already modifying and handling these vehicles, so it's can get to market very quickly. And we're just kind of in that stage of going from proving the technology works, that the customers see the value, that we provide good service and good operation. We're well over 1 million miles now of commercial fleet experience in the last 6 months with the new rollout. And we're getting all the right feedback to start scaling that up into more real production numbers. Mm-hmm.
So let's say I had a commercial van and I think, hey, I like what Todd's saying. What would it cost me to convert? And I'll make up a number. I drive 40,000 miles a year. What could I save?
So it depends on volume. We're kind of in the 8 to 10,000 range, depending on if you're buying one or 100 plus or 250 plus.
8 to 10,000 to convert a truck to be a hybrid.
That's the cost. So about 8 or 9,000 is really the...
So you're very competitive with the people who are converting to run on CNG, compressed natural gas, or propane.
We're lower cost than a lot of the CNG solutions that are out there for the same customers that we're selling to. And the payback that the customer at 40 years, if you're doing 40,000 miles a year, you're going to be saving over $3,000 per year, approximately. So you would get... You know, you'd get better than a 3-year payback at that level.
Can I ask you, how big is your system? What's the electric motor? What's the battery capacity?
We really designed it around charge rate, so capturing energy normally wasted in braking. It's a 40-kilowatt system, 1.8-kilowatt-hour battery pack, so it's a relatively small pack.
Yeah, okay.
Batteries are still expensive, and the first kilowatt-hour gets you your best economic benefits, your biggest bang for the buck. So that's why we went with the hybrid system. It's about... You know, it's the size of a small suitcase. It's 90 pounds. It can be installed very easily.
Lithium-ion or?
It's lithium-ion. It's manufactured by Johnson Controls. Mm-hmm. So we worked jointly with them to get this product customized for our application.
And, of course, you're putting this on vehicles that are body-on-frame, that have all kinds of room under the truck to package all this.
Plenty of room. Rear-wheel drive. Mounts right to the rear of the transmission. Mm-hmm. The motor adds an additional 220 pound-feet of torque. So it's got a significant boost, and customers that are buying new vehicles can go from a 6-liter down to a 4.8, save some more money up front, about $1,000, $800, and then get some additional fuel savings as well.
Oh, very interesting. Chris, I got to get you into this because, you know, we talked a little bit earlier how many turbochargers BorgWarner makes. We're seeing automakers put smaller and smaller engines in their cars and then turbocharging them.
Sure.
Ford has shown us a 3-cylinder, 1-liter engine. Fiat over in Europe has a 2-cylinder engine. My question to you is, how small are these engines going to get?
Well, if you look at what's going on in Japan, that they're going down to the 660cc engines. But the reality is all of the clearances between the compressor and the compressor housing and the turbine and the turbine housing, they're all the same. And as you go down in scale, the turbocharger still works, but the efficiency is more challenging. And so those tolerances really become a lot of the art and the science in making some of those small turbos. So you can go smaller. Do you get the same peak efficiencies? Probably not. We're still... still innovating and creating new ways of getting there. So.
And, of course, when you say 660 cc's in Japan, you're talking about the little K cars that they have, which would never stand up to any of our crash standards. So
they wouldn't, but I think the real boundary is how big are the engines, right? Mm-hmm. And how big can you really turbocharge, or how small can they go and still turbocharge them? Mm-hmm. And that seems to be about the boundary.
About 660 cc.
Yeah, I think that's going much smaller is not very productive.
There's not a big gain to do that.
No, and even those are challenging, as I say, that the clearances and the tolerances become really an issue. So.
And, of course, I grew up, I think we all did, in an era where a transmission, at least an automatic transmission, typically had 3 gears.
Right.
I remember when 4 was something, then 6 was phenomenal. Now we're up to 9 in some cases. 10 speeds are right around the corner. How many gears can they stuff into a transmission?
I get asked this question a lot. I think the answer is until there's no more benefit, right? And so if you go through the numbers and look at that, for years we said 5 speeds got 90% of the benefit, and then 6 speeds got a bit more of that benefit, and that we also make improvements in the clutches and the drag losses, which then mean that adding an extra clutch isn't a fuel economy penalty. Mm. And so it's a science of a lot of incremental improvements. Is it going to end at 11 or 12 or 13? You know, my bet's on 12. I've got some bets riding on that, but.
But isn't it? I mean, you said until there's no more benefit. You're talking like an engineer. In some of these cases, these car companies are bragging, "Yeah, we got more gears than anybody else." And so, I mean, part of it comes down to marketing a benefit as well, right?
It does, but you still have to be able to use them, and you still have to be able to have seamless shifts between them, and not have it too busy. If all the time you're shifting, that's probably not going to be as efficient a transmission as one that's actually in gear and with the clutches locked up.
You know, as we talk about green cars or cars that, you know, are alternative energy ones, Oliver, sales just are not keeping pace. I mean, the consumer is not playing his and her role in doing this. In fact, we've seen green car sales, I'm talking about hybrids, plug-ins, and electric cars, as a group, we've seen their sales go down in the United States so far this year.
Have you looked at April's numbers?
Yes, I have.
Gas prices are going up.
Yeah.
You could see over the last month, truck sales picking up, passenger cars going down or being at the same level. April sales totally reversed this. Trucks are going down, passenger cars are up by 9%. And you see the same, last month we sold the most TDIs ever in a month. So at the moment...
TDI, which you mean, of course, is diesel engine.
It's our direct injected turbocharged diesel engine. And we had the biggest sales of them in a month ever.
And that's what I'm getting at.
For me, it's a function of the gas price. It's really, this $4 seems to be something of a psychological barrier. So if the gas price is below $4, it looks like people don't care what they buy. And honestly, yeah, an Audi S7 is nicer than an Audi A8 with a 3-liter TDI. Nobody can argue this, but it all then in the end comes really down to cost of ownership. Then they somehow put their commercial vehicle hat on and think about it. And this is what we see always with the gas prices. Last year, I remember Toyota announced in the middle of the year they will not meet their Prius sales target because the gas price is below $350. So it's really a function of the gas price.
I think in the consumer market, the penetration of customers that are willing to pay more to be green was hit a long time ago in 2006, 2000, probably 2005. We hit the kind of 2 to 3% of the market. And that was when there were only a handful of hybrids available. There weren't even any plug-ins or electric vehicles available. And even though the amount of hybrids and plug-ins has increased significantly across the board, there's 30, 40, 50 different options now, that 2 to 3% is still stayed at that level, kind of going up and down based on fuel prices. So I think the big driver in the longer term for getting more electrification is going to be in CAFE requirements. I mean, the OEMs can hit a lot of the targets in the short term, the next 5 years, through efficiency and lightweighting and a lot of, call it low-hanging fruit, but eventually, 2025 timeframe, they're going to have to get some more electrification, I think, in the core vehicles.
But I think you're thinking of full hybrids when you're talking about these hybrids. Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
I think the big market growth is going to be in the 48-volt mild hybrids.
Yeah.
So these will
explain those a bit for the audience who may not know what a 48-volt hybrid is.
So a 48-volt mild hybrid basically has a belt alternator starter, and it has a slightly larger battery, and it can recover just enough energy to do the regenerative braking and then put it back into the powertrain during accelerations. And you get maybe 80% of the benefit of a full hybrid, but the added cost is maybe a sixth or even less, maybe a seventh
of the
total
question.
Cost.
It's really the question, do I make 20% of my fleet full hybrid, or do I make 40% of my fleet to the 48-volt? And the one big advantage of 48-volt, we see at the moment that the stop-start systems in the U.S., I would say, fail. It's just they fail.
Fail in what way?
Customer acceptance.
The people do not like it.
We had BMW doing their reflash last year when they switched from the last from the always on to the last mode system. So this means when the customer gets in the car, the system used to be on. So now he can decide by a button how the system would like to be. This is how we sell the system at the moment. And the big thing there is really the customer being afraid, getting stuck somewhere on an on-ramp, and the NVH when starting the engine. This is what they don't like. They are sitting there in their car. It feels nice until the moment when the engine is restarting. And this is going away with a 48-volt system.
Well, it does. But also, I mean, John and I have talked in the past about this shake on the restart. And I think what you actually find is there's pre-ignition occurring in the first cylinder event. And so we've actually gone, we actually talked, I think, 2 years ago about this, and we've actually gone off and developed a new product to be able to solve that problem. And so our dual-lock cam phaser, which has one position for starting hot and one position for starting cold, basically can solve that problem. And so the shakes just go away in the vehicle. Basically, well, I should say totally go away. They're reduced by about 65 or 70%. Mm.
And as we talked about back then, too, some automakers seem to do a better job than other automakers on this.
But they make compromises in engine mounts that then, with idle quality compromises and compromises driving down the road. Yeah, so there's always...
But nevertheless, it's still a function of the difference between an electric starter where I turn my engine with 150, maybe 200 RPMs when the engine is warm, and the electric system where I can turn my engine much faster.
Sure, 400 RPM.
Yeah, 400 RPM, that's double the RPM, and it feels much better for the customer.
We purposely avoided stop-start to avoid a lot of these problems. There are fuel-saving opportunities, but our customers, it's really about capturing that energy that's wasted and braking. Mm-hmm. You're moving 10, 20,000 pounds, accelerating it, and then all that energy gets wasted, or most of it gets wasted in the brakes. And that's really what we're targeting. But I would agree that the mild approach, we can get 80% of the benefits of a full hybrid with the system that we've developed. There are competitors out there with systems that can do electric-only driving for 10 or 20 miles. But if you're driving 100 or even 200 miles a day, what do you care if you're doing 10 or 20 miles on electric-only?
Plus, that adds a huge battery pack.
Unbelievable costs. I mean, you're talking $50,000 premiums in some cases, 30, in some other cases, some even a full electric, 100,000 plus for vehicles that are driving. And even then, they can't meet the operational requirements of the customer. They can't, 70-100 miles a day is maybe. So you're seeing a lot of things that are heavily subsidized to get them on the road. But I would agree that the mild approach has the most financial benefit, most economic benefit.
I think the other thing, you got to look at the voltage, right? 60 volts is sort of the threshold of where, if something happens, people die above 60 volts, right? And so below 60 volts, all of the connectors don't have to be the high safety connectors, and you don't have to have a dedicated ground. So all your wiring is cut in half, and all the connectors are conventional connectors that are already used in vehicles today. So the cost of going from a 60 volt system to a 70 volt system, the cost basically quadruples. So sticking below 60, which is sort of where that 48 volt nominal voltage is, I think is where the growth's going to be.
Chris, do you see the whole car convert? We've had 12 volts since the mid 1950s. I want to say, do you see the whole car going 48?
No, I think if you start thinking about the motors that wind your windows up, and a lot of the other low voltage things that are in the vehicle, as well as your charger for your iPhone, all of these things run at 12 volts, right?
So you'd have to change everything.
Well, you'd have to change everything, and that's really what stopped the industry switching to 42 volts, 10 years ago or so. So I think you'll end up with two voltage board nets on the vehicle, and you'll end up with a 48 volt and a 12 volt.
There's one advantage that you could use on the 48. So everything that has a big and heavy electric motor, like your fans or maybe your windscreen wiper or stuff like this, there you could make use of the 48 once it's established, and you can downsize those things, and then you're back in the lightweighting area.
Oliver, there's been a lot more talk in Europe lately about going to 48 volt across the board. What do you hear? What can you tell us?
Yeah, there is various systems, and it's mainly driven by suppliers. So the thing is, now I have to mention now others than in a new company, but there's a very aggressive push, for example, by Valeo. Valeo is promoting their system since, I would say, 5, 6, 7 years. And I see this coming. I think you had plenty of those discussions. If you look at the regulations regarding fuel economy, yes, the U.S. is tough, and it's tough because of the fleet composition. So your vehicles here in the U.S. are much bigger than our vehicles in Europe. But if you put it in perspective, the European targets of 95 grams in 2020 and then 2025, maybe 70 grams, this is more stringent than the U.S. targets. So in order to achieve those targets, you need to do something. And we discussed this already before. you can decide, do I do full hybridization on 20% of my fleet, or do I do the other one on 40%? And it's
or
only
60%.
Yeah, or 60%, and it's only a fifth or sixth of the cost. So it's, I think it's an easy decision. I think we will see these systems coming.
Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say the other thing too is, you know, I don't think that the 95 grams in 2021 in Europe is the end.
No, we already talk about 2025, 70 grams.
And I think by 2030, you'll be down, you know.
California is talking
grams.
Zero in 2050.
So,
and one of these days we have to talk to the oil companies about taking the carbon out of the fuel instead of having the car companies try to reduce it on the engine side. That's just a personal opinion. Todd, quick, we're down to the very end here, but I think you get the last say in this. Seems to me like you've got the best of both worlds here. You don't have to worry about corporate average fuel economy legislation. You don't have to worry about a ZEV mandate or a CO2 reduction. All you have to do is come up with customers who want to save money.
That's correct. You do have to, you know, get your cost down, offer a product at scale, get production capacity that can deliver the demands of customers that are very demanding. I mean, these are some of the most well-run fleets in the world. So you really have to be able to deliver on the promise in order to get them to buy. And, you know, we've proven we can get that far. It's only taken 5 years. But we definitely see a great opportunity to start scaling up this business and being a leader in the industry on the commercial vehicle side.
I want to thank all three of you for a great conversation here. Obviously, we just scratched the surface. We're going to be doing more shows in the future on powertrain. But Oliver Schmidt from Volkswagen, Todd Haynes from XL Hybrids, and Chris Thomas from BorgWarner, thanks so much for having joined me on Autoline this week.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.